Speaking of liberty, the National Broadcasting Company presents another in a special series of programs under the auspices of the Council for Democracy. There was free talk in the old New England town hall and around the Cracker Barrel in the Crossroads store. And there's free talk by free men every week at this time on the air, led by our host, Rex Stout. Many of you may already know Rex Stout as the creator of Nero Wolfe, criminologist extraordinary. On this program, you will get to know him even better as an outspoken champion of our American democracy. Mr. Stout.
Thank you, George Hicks. Good evening, friends of liberty. We Americans don't like it that the average Englishman knows nothing of Thomas Jefferson, except that he was some kind of an American who did something or other. But what does the average American know of Simon Bolivar? Yet Bolivar was one of the truly great men of our own new world. The Encyclopedia Britannica says, Bolivar's life presents one of history's most colossal personal canvases of adventure and tragedy, glory and defeat. And most of us are grossly ignorant, not only of South America's past, but even of her present. It's high time we learned something about the southern half of this hemisphere, which we have sworn to defend against transoceanic gangsters. One American who realized that fact some time ago is here as our guest today. Carl Crowe returned recently from an extensive and comprehensive tour of Latin America. If you confuse him with the famous Carl Crowe, who has spent half his working life in China, and who wrote those informative and delightful books, 400 Million Customers and Master Kung, and numerous others about China, Japan, and the Philippines, that's all right, he's the same man.
Not exactly the same, Mr. Stout. With the world in convulsions, I doubt if any man alive is the same as he was 2 years ago. For instance, speaking of liberty, all of us love democracy more or less than we did before Hitler turned his armies loose.
I love it more.
So do I.
Then we won't quarrel about that, Mr. Crowe. We're among friends. What about South America? Did you feel you were among friends there? Are those countries, in fact, democracies?
Yes and no. It depends on your standard. If you mean are they perfect democracies, certainly not. There are none. You don't regard the United States as a perfect democracy, do you?
By no means. Far from it. But it's nothing to be ashamed of. We've done pretty well, and we're trying hard.
So are the South American countries. If they haven't come quite as far as we have, remember we have a head start of 50 years. Our Declaration of Independence dates from 1776, and Argentina didn't get hers until 1821. Bolivar was still fighting the Spaniards in Peru in 1824.
50 years. Would you say that they are now as far along as we were in 1890?
Hardly, because it isn't just a matter of time. You see, the people who settled North America were pioneers in search of religious freedom. They were mostly English and represented the great commercial democracy that was just developing. They came over here to build homes, and they weren't afraid of work. Also, they already had an idea of self-government.
And, of course, that wasn't true of the Spaniards and Portuguese who settled South America.
Not at all. They came entirely for exploitation. And their ideas of politics and social organizations were completely feudal. Aristocrats and gentlemen adventurers on top, peons and slaves at the bottom. The gentlemen adventurers were too proud to work. And their main idea was to grab off a fortune as quickly as possible and get back home to enjoy it. The ideas and customs of an old world feudal society lingered on in most of the South American countries from the days of conquistadors, and they haven't yet disappeared. And then, of course, if you're comparing democracy in North and South America, remember that the people themselves are different.
Different how?
Up here, we're fairly much alike. We're a nation of 100% middle-class consumers. Down in South America, the countries are as varied as the colors of a rainbow. Argentina and Uruguay, for example, are almost 100% white and proud of it. Just a little to the north is Brazil. It's a mixture of everything, and Brazilians are equally proud of that. A Brazilian friend of mine told me that a true Brazilian was a sort of a human cocktail. White, black, maybe a dash of yellow and red, a sort of a racial pousse-café.
Well, then what kind of an outlook is there for what the statesmen call hemispheric solidarity? If the various peoples of South America are all so different, what'll pull them together? What chance is there of really effective cooperation against totalitarianism?
That brings up a very interesting problem, Mr. Stout, because the same factors work in both ways. All of the countries of South America are intensely nationalistic and patriotic. They're proud of themselves and of what they've accomplished, and they're just as jealous and jealous and suspicious of their neighbors. I mean, they're just as suspicious of each other as they are of us. But at the same time, this very nationalism makes them determined to run their own affairs and resentful of any attempt at dictation from abroad.
So you'd say that while there isn't much chance of a South American federal union like ours, there also isn't much chance of domination by foreigners or foreign dictators.
Federal union was the ideal of Simon Bolivar, the great liberator, but it didn't work out. There were too many national jealousies and rivalries then, and there have been too many ever since then.
Well, what about the infiltration and eventual domination by outsiders, for instance, the Nazis?
I don't think that's likely, except by force. I know what's in your mind, Mr. Stout. You're thinking that because a good many governments in South America have been called dictatorships, there's a natural sympathy for Nazism and fascism. There have been a good many governments in the history of South America that have been organized and run by so-called strongmen. But South Americans as a whole have never given up their faith in the democratic ideal. They haven't attained it. They have made mistakes just as we do, and occasionally they're in the hands of a Huey Long. They have a property qualification on voting, but we still have a poll tax in some states. But the important thing is that they're working towards a more democratic democracy as a great goal of the future. All over South America, the ideal is political and social democracy on the North American pattern.
Well, a lot of people in the United States feel that the countries of Latin America are governed chiefly by palace revolutions.
I don't think that's fair. Take the case of Colombia, for example. There hasn't been a contested presidential election in Colombia for the last 100 years. The only real revolution they've ever had was one 40 years ago over an attempt to overthrow the Constitution. There are 9 million people in Colombia, but only 20% of them are literate white voters. The rest are Indians. But the last election, over 900,000 voters went to the polls.
Not so bad. One voter in every 2 going to the polls. Or wait a minute, what about women? Is there woman suffrage in Colombia?
Mr. Stout, I can't tell you. I asked 4 Colombians, and 2 said yes and 2 said no.
I see. It depends on their wives, and that's really pure democracy. But tell me something, Mr. Crow. You said that the South American ideal in politics and administration was on the North American pattern.
That's true, Mr. Stout.
Well, I'm surprised at that because I thought we'd been pretty generally disliked and distrusted in South America.
I know, the cost of the North and all that business. That has been true in the past, and it still lingers on. But recently, there's been quite a change for the better.
Due to what? The good neighbor policy?
Quite definitely. The 2 greatest men in Latin American eyes are President Roosevelt and Mr. Hull.
Well, what has the good neighbor policy actually accomplished, Mr. Crow?
More cooperation between neighbors in South America, and much more cooperation between the South American countries and ourselves. For a while, there was a great deal of cynicism. We talked about loans, and there have been too many loans in the past, private loans, that were made purely for exploitation. But when the really constructive loans of the Import-Export Bank came along to provide for factories and provide developed natural resources, people began to feel that the good neighbor policy really was something.
Well, you say the money is being used to build factories. Won't that interfere with our export trade?
No, because the whole idea is to make South America self-sufficient in the field of cheap consumer goods, which we don't export from the United States and which in the past have been bought from Germany and Japan. And also to help them develop raw materials, resources, materials that we've been buying elsewhere and can now buy from our neighbors in the South.
How do the Nazis like that?
They don't like it at all, but there isn't much that they can do.
Are they trying?
They're trying, Mr. Stout, but they can't make deliveries now, and they're not getting very far. Even in the years between 1932 and 1938, when the Nazis were being told by Hitler that they must export or die, German trade in South America increased only 15%. In those same 6 years, our own trade increased 164%. And in 1938, the last normal year, our exports to the 20 Latin American republics were greater than the combined exports of Germany, Great Britain, and Japan.
Well, how did we do it?
For one thing, we did it with commercial integrity. I know that sounds like a slogan for a Rotary Club, but in the main, it's true.
Well, what about the export of propaganda? What about the millions of German colonists in South America? What about the recent Nazi plot in Uruguay?
That's a very difficult question, Mr. Stout. The Uruguay outbreak was very disturbing, and it indicated Nazi penetration had gone much farther than people realized. And there's plenty of evidence of their work throughout South America. All we can do is to keep our eyes open and work harder than ever to make sure that American influence, and by that I mean the influence, our own North American influence, is strong enough to beat the Nazis at their own game.
Well, how does Hitler's propaganda machine work in South America?
Much as it does everywhere else, I don't think the Nazi agents are quite as numerous as we've been led to believe, but they're very busy and tireless. Every consulate has a large staff with press attachés and other agents, all of them very active. The so-called fifth columnists are trying to work with the minorities. And there's aboard there the Berlin shortwave broadcast, but ours are much more popular. And of course they try to keep control of the German population in general. But even there, they have their troubles. A whole lot of Germans in South America hate the Nazis and say so. In my opinion, the number of Germans in South America has been greatly exaggerated. Most of those classified as Germans only had a German grandfather, like Wendell Willkie, and certainly he is no Nazi. In all South America, only one political leader I know of has come out openly in favor of the Nazi cause and the Nazi philosophy. He is a member of an opposition party with a local reputation for being eccentric and against everything.
You certainly are no alarmist, Mr. Crow. I can hardly see the cloud for the silver lining. But what if Hitler wins his war?
You mean really wins it? Wins control of the oceans? In that case, Mr. Stout, everyone in the world would be either a prisoner or a Nazi or dead. It wouldn't matter what you thought or what the South Americans thought. By control of trade routes, raw materials, and by possession of a dominant navy, the Nazis would make of the American hemisphere a collection of colonies which they could exploit at their leisure. The only difference between the United States and the other American countries is that we would be the biggest colony. But returning to the present situation, I didn't mean to indicate that there wasn't any danger or that we could afford to ignore the German strategy in South America. They never lose a chance to picture us as a selfish, imperialist power, exploiting our neighbors. And don't forget, the distrust and suspicion of the United States are always very near the surface.
Which we have no right to kick about. We haven't always been the good neighbors.
No, our motives haven't always been so pure and unselfish, and the South Americans haven't forgotten it. They're keenly aware of their own economic and military weakness, and they're a very proud and sensitive people. Proud of their culture and their heritage, just as we are. We've got to remember those things when we deal with them.
And I take it you did find a good many friends of liberty on your trip down there, Mr. Crow.
Yes, I did. I talked with a great many people of all classes and kinds. And there isn't a doubt in my mind about their devotion to democracy. Mr. Stout, there are traces, and even more than traces, of feudalism to be found everywhere. But it's dying, and everyone knows that it is. As we agreed a while ago, there isn't any pure democracy anywhere. South American democracy is younger than ours, and it has gone out of a more difficult past. But it has the same goal, and personally I'm convinced that with time and experience and understanding on our part and genuine cooperation in defense and trade, that goal will be achieved.
Thank you, Mr. Crow. Ladies and gentlemen, our guest today is Carl Crow, world traveler, writer, and authority on the foreign trade of the United States. This is Rick Stout saying goodbye until next week.
Thank you, and you've just heard the 14th of a special series of programs entitled Speaking of Liberty, brought to you each week by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with the Council for Democracy, a national organization dedicated to the propagation of an American faith in democracy. And next week, Rex Stout will bring Bertrand Russell to the microphone. A copy of the script of this broadcast will be mailed free to anyone requesting it. Please address your letter or card to the Council for Democracy, 285 Madison Avenue, New York City. That's the Council for Democracy at 285 Madison Avenue, New York City. Speaking of Liberty has been presented as a public service by NBC and the independent radio stations associated with the Red Network of the National Broadcasting Company.